morning. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I understand that the question that Robin had that we couldn't hear was a mix of question regarding the holidays that are celebrated by Muslims versus those that are on Yahweh's Torah calendar, and asking if there was any intersection because they did copy a number of things from Rabbinic Judaism. The answer is no. There isn't a single overlap between the Torah instructions and what Muslims celebrate, which is kind of odd, of course, because the Quran claims that it confirms the Torah, and yet the Torah has seven very explicit days that Yahweh has established for us to meet with him, and not one of them is mentioned in Islam. There is one Jewish religious holiday that some Muslims celebrate. It is only celebrated in Shiite Islam, which represents about 10% of Muslims, and it is in association with the rabbinic baggage from their Babylon occupation and captivity, where they began to celebrate Asherah Day, which is a day that honors the goddess for whom Assyria was founded. And so when Muhammad saw religious rabbinical Jews celebrating this Asherah Day as a legacy of their Babylonian captivity, he said, you know, we're is equally entitled to anything that the Jews are doing, that they're doing, so we too will do it. But it isn't a day that carried on into Sunni Islam, because that day then was also associated with the death of Muhammad's grandson, and collectively it's just become a mess. But the direct answer to your question is, are there overlaps? No, none. There really is no overlap between Islam and Yahweh's Torah, other than the, some of the names of individuals in the Torah are used to create the illusion that the Quran is a credible text. But the stories of those people are so corrupted, so convoluted, so inconsistent with the actual history of those individuals. For anybody with an open and rational mind, it's nothing but an embarrassment. Speaking of not offering false testimony, which is the entirety of the Quran, the Quran from beginning to end is nothing but false testimony. Yahweh says you should never respond and testify, and it's actually, rather than never, it should, you should not make a habit of responding and testifying against your neighbor. Don't testify on an ongoing basis in conjunction with a countryman, friend, companion, or associate, really anyone that's in your sphere of influence, as a deceptive or misleading witness. So the very nature of the Christian religion, based on Paul's letters, is based entirely on deceptive and misleading testimony. The nature of the Islamic religion, based entirely on deceptive and misleading testimony. The basis, really, of every religion that has been practiced by man is a witness, someone who claimed to be a messenger of God, deceiving, misleading, providing false and unreliable information to those within their sphere of influence, their countrymen, their friends, their companions, their associates. It is also true to a large degree now in politics. And there's some aspects of politics where you can say, you know, this might have begun as a noble campaign, but it has not ended that way, almost never does. So we're dealing with the essence of religion and politics when we consider false testimony. And it's far beyond Raya, your neighbor, because Raya really means everyone that you would encounter. Anyone within your country, anyone that you associate with as a friend, a companion, anyone that you're going to encounter along life's way. This is how, as we know, that Satan beguiled Adam and Chawa in the garden. He misquoted God. He got Chawa to misquote God, took a statement that God made out of context to infer the opposite of what God had actually intended, and so beguiled through this corruption of God's testimony, man was booted out of the Garden of Eden. It is the principal means that was used to empower and enrich Rabbi Akiva, the Apostle Paul, the wannabe prophet Muhammad. And as a direct result of the violation of this instruction from Yahweh that he etched in stone, billions upon billions of gullible souls have been misled throughout the centuries. It is a horrible crime. It is an unforgivable sin. If you're going to speak for God, quote him accurately. If you're going to be a witness, recite his testimony. Don't change it. And yet, in defiance of the application of the call stem and the imperfect conjugation on this statement, particularly in association with lo ana, which is the verb, you should not make a habit of consistently responding and testifying against those that you have influence over in a deceptive and misleading manner as a witness. Lo ana is probably the crux of much misleading testimony, by particularly by rabbis. They have created the impression that on the day of reconciliations, Yah 6 of 7, Moed Mikre, that we are to anah, afflict our souls, debasing them, and that's the way that we reconcile ourselves with Yahweh, that we sacrifice ourselves, that we demean ourselves, is the way that God would reconcile the relationship to uplift us and empower us and enrich us. Of course, it sounds asinine. It's illogical. It's irrational. It paints God as mean-spirited, but that's, I guess, the impression that they want to convey, and that's the impression that is the celebration of Yom Kippur in Judaism. They afflict themselves on Yom Kippur. And yet, that's not what God said. On that day, on the day of reconciliations, he simply wants us to respond to his invitation and to meet with him. That's all he's asking. In the end, all we really have from God is life, free will, and a conscience, and his testimony, of course. If we corrupt it, the first three gifts are for naught. If when we do what religions have done and twist and pervert his testimony, then the fact that God gave us mortal life, free will, and a conscience, they're all worthless. Those who have read An Introduction to God are especially familiar with anah, the operative verb in this statement. It became our constant companion throughout the journey to meet and embrace Yahweh. We first encountered anah in kara, which means called out. It's an invitation to meet, corrupted to Leviticus 23, 26, and 27. And there we read. Then Yahweh declared the word to Moshe, saying, on the 10th of the 7th month is the day of reconciliations. This exists as a set apart and cleansing called out invitation to meet with you. And your soul shall respond and answer, anah, shall reply to the summons, making a declaration after engaging in thought, vocally communicating while appearing before and approaching the feminine aspect of the light unto Yahweh. The feminine aspect of Yahweh's light is the set-apart spirit. We simply come into her presence so that we can approach Yahweh on the day of reconciliations, and our relationship with him is reconciled. We appear perfect in his eyes when we do. But even in light of the fact that Yahweh etched the explicit instruction not to respond by testifying falsely in stone, Jewish and Christian clerics have almost universally rendered anah as afflict rather than respond and answer, make a declaration, falsely communicating the religious notion that the means to resolve our relationship with God is to injure ourselves. And as a result of their misleading witness, as few as one soul in a million properly responds to Yahweh's invitation to reconcile our covenant relationship with him on this day. And God concluded his written testimony by encouraging us not to covet that which belongs to others, which is the last of the seven instructions. It is interesting, by the way, that Anah here, that this statement that defines Anah is was the sixth of seventh instructions. And I should tell you and remind you that the Moed Mikre, the Day of Reconciliations, that is based upon Anah and understanding what Anah means to respond and answer, to provide a witness, that Anah is the operative verb of both of the six of seven statements that Yah etched in stone, and is the operative verb of the six of seven Moed Mikre, of the meetings that God invited us to attend so that we could walk to him and live in his home. I don't suppose that was a coincidence. Well, we have now reached the seventh of the seven instructions that God etched in stone. It is an encouragement not to covet that which belongs to others. And yet, even in this, man's governance is rooted in this very thing. Rabbis craved the authority which was rightly God's, and thereby empowered and enriched themselves. You know, there are very few institutions that covet what others have earned, what others have retained, what others have, more than religious institutions. I mean, there are not a whole lot of institutions whose services that you can attend that that include as the central part of their meeting a collection. There's not many television programs other than religious ones that end with a call to send us money. Or if you go to their buildings, that pass the collection plate. If you go into impoverished cities throughout South and Central America, there is always one building that stands out gilded, grand. Catholic churches in those communities. When we look at those who covet what belongs to others, religious leaders are at the top of the list. Paul, a rabbi by training, alleged God's authority to claim the Gentiles as his own, and he, in his letters, often spoke about the idea that it was appropriate for his followers to pay him money. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yetta. We just received a phone call during the break from Sharon calling in from Colorado on a related topic. She wanted to know about the tithe, which is what the Christian church uses to try to confiscate money from their devotees. And it's interesting, of course, that the Christian church ignores universally the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. They focused entirely on what they call a New Testament, which is comprised largely of Paul's writings. And yet they want to pluck this this word tithe out of the what they call the Old Testament. It's that kind of selective mentality that tells you that they're absolute pure hypocrites. So with all of Yah's insistence on keeping the Shabbat as a special day, all of God's insistence on you need to meet with me these seven times a year, this is the means to your salvation, with all of God's insistence that there's only one covenant, so there can't be a new covenant, and that you participate in that covenant by accepting the its terms and conditions. With all of that, that God's saying, I have only one name, my name is Yahweh, which means my name can't be Jesus Christ. My name is Yahweh, period, end of conversation. That's my only name for all time. They ignore all of that. All of it. And instead, they'll look for what can we find there that we can actually use to enrich ourselves. And what they find is tithe. Now, let's explain the tithe, because it is an insightful thing. This is now speaking of the of Shavua and of Yahweh's recipe for Shavuas, where we come up toward Isharon, and Isharon is the word that is misrendered tithe. Yahweh says, so this is now for Shavuah, which is the fourth of the Moed Mikre when we meet with God. He says, you should come bringing out of your homes two loaves of bread, and as an ascending wave offering, a double portion for a tenfold enrichment and empowerment. So the word Isharon, which is translated tithe, has to be taken out of context because God is saying that the benefit here, the ones who are being enriched and empowered tenfold, are us, not him. It's not saying, I want you to give 10% of your income. He's saying, I'm going to enrich and empower you tenfold. And it's even called a double portion. So it's preceded with a double portion. It's tied to the loaves of bread. The loaves of bread represent the benefit of matzah. You know, Yosha's body served as the Passover lamb, and his soul was leavened for our benefit, so that our sin, represented by yeast, was placed on him. So God's saying, you know, all I want you to do is come out of your home with a couple of loaves of bread. Now, if two loaves of bread represents the entirety of 10% of your earnings during a year, then I guess you could say, all right, you know what we ought to do here then for the Christian church is that once a year, let's bring them a couple of loaves of bread. That would be following Yah's example. So he's saying, because of the symbolism that's associated with this on Shavuot, I want you to come out of your homes carrying two loaves of bread as an ascending offering. It is to show that this is an offering that will cause you to ascend. And then he says it's a double portion because there's two things that are going to be conveyed here for a tenfold enrichment and empowerment. The two things are enrichment and empowerment. Yahweh, as part of his covenant, tells us that he's going to enrich us because we become his heirs. When you are an heir to an extraordinarily wealthy individual, you are enriched by being their child. And that is the purpose of the covenant. We're enriched. Now, the most valuable thing that Yahweh has to give us is his Torah teaching. So we're enriched with his Torah. We are empowered. We are mortal. We're, you know, in these physical bodies that are so diminished from our spiritual potential. They're diminished, according to Einstein, at the multiplication of the speed of light times the speed of light. That's how diminished we are. We're going to be empowered. We're going to go from being frail, mortal, physical individuals to being spiritual individuals. And that's the word that is translated tithe. It is a combination, a compound of Esher, which means ten and tenfold, Asar, which is to enrich, and Own, which is to empower so that one grows. So that's the answer. If the church asks you for a tithe, you'll say that why don't you ask for any of the other things that Yahweh clearly said are important in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And if you want the Isharon, it's supposed to be for me, not for you. And, oh, by the way, it's described as two loaves of bread. Here you are. Have a good lunch. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're going to continue with Yah's seventh of seven instructions that he etched on the second of two tablets, 77 words, just as there were 77 words on the first of two tablets. He says the following in his last written declaration, his summation of his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. You'll find this in Shemoth, which means names, or Exodus 20:17, as it has been corrupted. You should not continually desire your neighbor's house or family. You should not consistently desire your neighbor's wife, nor his male or female servants, his cattle, his donkey, which would in today's world would be his vehicles, his means of production, or anything which is associated with your neighbor. So it's don't covet. Don't make a practice of or a habit of coveting, lusting for, craving for, seeking pleasure from your countrymen, your friends, your companions, your associates, house, or family. And yet, what do? We in this country. We tax them, don't we? We tax the house, we tax the household, we tax the family. We covet what they have. Taxes really is a form of coveting in this regard. We ought not do that. That's what he says. You should not desire a neighbor, a friend, a companion, or associate's wife. You should not covet their employees, their associates, their vehicles, or anything which is associated with your neighbor, your countryman, your friend, your companions, or your associates. The violation of this, Yahweh's seventh instruction, is the root of much evil. Desiring that which does not belong to them has motivated cleric and king, as well as generals, throughout the ages. Mankind has conquered. Mankind has plundered. Mankind has subjugated the masses, stealing their wives, slaving their children, robbing their land, and confiscating their possessions. Now, we have done it for millennia in a savage way. You look at the birth of Islam. Muhammad led 75 terrorist raids in the first 10 years of the Islamic era. Within 100 years of Muhammad's death, Muslims savaged much of the world, conquering, plundering, raping, stealing, robbing, doing all manner of heinous behaviors. That's how the religion of Islam was established. For most of its 2,000 years, particularly in the 1,500 years following Constantine's creation of the Roman Catholic Church, it conquered. In fact, what was the first sign that Constantine saw? Emblazoned on the sun was the sign which was his god, was the sign of his god, which was a pagan cross, the capital or the lowercase letter T from our perspective. And I heard a voice under this sign, conquer. When you conquer, you're taking from someone else because you covet. And what do they do when they conquer? They plunder. What do they do with the people who survive their conquering and plundering? They subjugate them. In many cases, they satiate the carnal desires of the soldiers who perpetrate their armed robbery with rape. In most cases, they enslave the children. That was what Rome was specifically heinous about doing. They rob the people of their land. They confiscate their possessions. Here in the call stem, it serves to discourage us from associating with covetous schemes of religion, politics, military, or economic institutions, because the statement is considered literal and genuine. And in the imperfect, it affirms that there are ongoing and unfolding consequences of habitually desiring that which belongs to others in any institution that constantly covets. You know, and the President of the United States now is a socialist, a communist. He wants the economy to run on the basis of from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. It is a government system, an economic system based on coveting. We have a call now from Lauren, who is calling in from Texas. Hello, Lauren.
Hello, Yada. How are you?
Wonderful.
Yes, on the topic that you're just covering about coveting what your neighbor has, I think it would be fair to include with Islam the formation of the modern state of Israel. I mean, did they not break virtually every commandment, to establish this modern state that they've got?
Are you talking about the Israelites? I broke all of the of Yah's seven instructions that he etched on the second of two tablets to establish the modern state of Israel. Are you talking about in Muslims wanting to conquer it, that they're in breach of all of them? Because if you look at Muhammad, he claimed that his Quran was a confirmation of the Torah, and yes, the centerpiece of the Torah is these 10 statements, and Muhammad personally violated all 10 of them. Now, as it relates to Israel's formation, the moment that Israel was given 0.2% of the land in the Middle East, Muslims had a conniption fit and decided they needed to take it for themselves.
Right. Well, I guess your point is taken, but my point is that everybody seems to choose a side in this, but very few people actually realize that both are wrong. And if you do the history on the formation of the modern state, if you listen to your evangelical preachers, they all want to tell you that this modern state of Israel is all of God. In fact, this is a huge movement within the evangelical community. And when I do the research, I find that it's nothing of the sort. And then,
I don't know.
How they get their followers to believe.
I'm certainly not going to defend Christianity, because Christianity is purely hypocritical. And for them to say that we're going to be supportive of Israel, which both nationally most Christian institutions are not, they're opposed to Israel. But for a local pastor in the evangelical movement to say we're going to support Israel by some token association with the covenant of Abraham, where I will bless those that bless thee and I will curse those that curse thee, while ignoring everything else in the Torah, is pure hypocrisy. As it relates to Israel and Israelites, Yehudim, deserving their homeland that was taken from them many times by the Greeks, by the Romans, by the Babylonians, the Byzantines, and then by Muslims, they are certainly entitled to a homeland. God gave it to them. They are a distinct race. They have survived, and it was a gift in the Torah to them. They certainly deserve their homeland.
My argument, though, would be if we have the Torah, which we have mm-hmm. the Ten Commandments, how can
they aren't commandments. They're statements,
well,
but okay.
If they violate just one of those commandments to get their homeland, then that would make God the ultimate hypocrite, would it not?
No, that's absurd. First of all, they're not commandments, so they are 10 statements, three of which are overall statements about Yahweh's nature, His name, His role as our Savior. His role in leading the children of Israel out of the crucible of Egypt and into this home. Where he says, I have but one name. My name is Yahweh. And so it is true that in rabbinical Judaism, they don't say his name, so that rabbinic Judaism would be inconsistent with the first statement that Yah etched in stone. Rabbinic Judaism is a religious environment, and God, in the second statement, said, don't be religious. If you want to have a relationship with me, don't corrupt your children with religion. Instead, walk to me in love, which is only one path to Yahweh, and do so by observing my terms and conditions of the covenant. So it is true that the government of Israel is inconsistent with God's Torah instructions, but the fact that he gave them this land and told us that they would return to the land makes him dependable, makes him honorable. It's the opposite of him being disingenuous. The fact that we as individuals, and particularly Yehudim, have acted deplorably and have done many things that are in direct conflict with God's instructions makes us the hypocrites, not him. So God told us that the covenant would be renewed. He said that I will honor all of the promises that I have made to Abraham, not because of who you are and what you do, but because of who I am. And so he has promised, returned his people to the land that he gave them. And ultimately they will reconcile their relationship with him, but not until the very last day. It'll be about 20 years from now before Yehudim finally reconcile their relationship with Yahweh. As for Christians, I don't hold out much hope. I don't think there will be very many Christians who ultimately reconcile their relationship with Yahweh. But Yehudim will, and God has made it possible for them to do so because of who he is, because he is dependable. But you really ought not look at these 10 statements as commandments. There's only one of them that was written in the imperative mood, and the one that was written in the imperative mood has to be volitional by nature. They are God calls them Ten Statements, and the Ten Statements, the first tablet, they're three sweeping statements that just define who he is and our relationship with him, and then there are seven specific instructions that guide our understanding of how we are to live with one another and with him. By the same token, Torah is not a set of laws. It is teaching and guidance and direction, and there is no Hebrew word for obey, so you know, you can't get to the point of saying, well, if you don't obey the Torah, then you aren't deserving of the benefits of the Torah, because there is no Hebrew word for obey. God is trying to teach us and guide us.
A movement within modern Judaism, and when I say modern, I mean we're going back to like the late 19th century, maybe even earlier, actually out of Solomon and the Babylonians, as far as I can tell, there's a gigantic Talmudic presence,
yeah,
and a Kabbalah as well. I mean,
yeah, uh-huh.
I find it very hard to reconcile all of this going on with, it all seems to be, when you say the word Jewish,
mm-hmm,
it encompasses a lot more than just the Torah, although I...
Oh, well, wait a minute.
Where do all the other elements come from?
Yeah. That's the biggest myth of Christendom, is to associate Yahweh and his Torah with being Jewish. There's one Torah for everyone. Rabbinic Judaism is based upon their oral law, and the oral law is principally comprised of arguments against the Torah. So the Talmud, of which there's two, the Jerusalem and the Babylonian Talmud, are arguments against the Torah. They're arguments against Yahweh, and that is what's caused the created the basis of Rabbinic Judaism. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. One of the great myths, maybe amongst the greatest of all myths, is that in Paul's letter, his formation of his Pauline doctrine, which was presented in his first letter, which was the letter to the Galatians, he spoke of the Torah and Judaizers in the same breath. Now, Judaizer isn't really a word. He made it up. What he did is he took and made Yahudim, which is related to Yah. It's the plural of Yahudah. It's a translated Jew, even though it means related to Yah, and the actual word is Yahudah, and in the plural, Yahudim. And he turned it into a verb. So he took a proper noun, turned it into a verb, and it's translated Judaizers. And he equated Judaizers with the Torah. So the vast majority of people now assume that the Jewish religion is based upon the Torah, that if you were a Torah observant, you would be a practicing Jew. That's not true. Rabbinical Judaism is not based on the Torah. It is based on the Talmud. It's based upon the Mishnah. It's based upon rabbinical arguments. And they claim that they're without any justification whatsoever, and in direct contradiction of what Yahweh has to say, that their oral traditions were given at the same time that the Torah was received. And they routinely focus on these oral arguments. In the Talmud, they come in two principal flavors, the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud started to be compiled around 100 BCE, and the Babylonian Talmud was officially published for the first time in about 500 CE. Islam is largely based on plagiarized and bastardized stories and accounts from the Babylonian Talmud. But when anyone begins to believe Paul that Judaism is somehow related to the Torah, when Yahweh spends most of the Torah prophets and Psalms denouncing his people for their religious affiliations and telling them that because they have become religious, that he is divorcing himself of them. That is the reality. They've suffered the diaspora and the conquest of their homeland all of these times because of their religion, and that their religion is incompatible with Yahweh's Torah teaching. Kabbalah, which our caller also mentioned, is a derivative of Rabbinic Judaism. Kabbalah is spiritualism where, which you get down to its root, it essentially has Yahweh and Satan inverted. And it is a highly demonic form of spiritualism. It was used extensively in the creation of the Third Reich. Nazism had a number of Kabbalists. This is the concluding testimony that Yahweh and Moshe shared with the children of Yisrael after a reading of these 10 statements. It says, these are the words Yahweh communicated, speaking to everyone assembled beside the mountain from the midst of the fire, and the water-laden crowd with a great and powerful voice. So these 10 statements, Yahweh articulated directly to his people. He not only wrote them in stone, he spoke them to us. He did not add anything more. He wrote them, engraving them on two tablets of stone, and he gave them to me, Moshe said. So let's review what God shared with Moshe, and then wrote on these two tablets of stone. And God conveyed all of these statements using words, providing perspective and our presence, saying, I am Yahweh, your God, who relationally and as a favor brought you out and delivered you from the realm of the crucible of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall not exist with other gods in relation to my presence. You should not ever do anything which associates yourself with a carved image or idol or religious icon or object of worship or any visual representation of something which is in the heavens above, which is on the earth below, or which is in the waters beneath the land. You should never bow down and worship them or speak for them or to them, and you shall not serve them. For indeed, I, Yahweh, your God, am a zealous and jealous God, counting and reckoning the perversity and sin of twisting and distorting of the fathers upon children concerning the third and fourth generations of those who genuinely are hostile to me, shunning me. But I will genuinely act and actually engage to literally prepare, perform, and produce unmerited and unfailing mercy, undeserved favor, and undeserved kindness on behalf of thousands who move toward me and who love me, and who approach me by closely observing and carefully considering my terms for participating in the relationship. It's advice to live by. If you want to make it past this life into the next one and spend your eternity in God's home, pay attention to what he said.